All right, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our main speaker, George.
Yeah. Hi, my name is George, and I am an alcoholic. Spoke with my sponsor a couple times a day, and spoke with him in the parking lot before I got here. It's been a rough couple of weeks for me. My sobriety date is December 1st, 2003. So if I can make it to midnight tonight, I'll have 12 years. And I got to admit, after this many days strung together, the past few weeks, past few months, have been kind of sketchy for me. My sponsor told me to share in a general way what happened, what it was like, and what it's like now. So I'm going to be as general as possible. Most of you know what's been going on in my life, and I'm going to come right out and say it. After 11 years, 364 days of sobriety, I come to find myself in this last year to be a liar, a manipulator, and a cheater. And that's the absolute truth. I'm putting it out there. After 11 years, 364 days, and that's where I am today. All right. What it was like. I was born in Brooklyn, New York. I was born to a Christian pastor and a Christian mother. My father, who fell from grace not too long afterwards. I still remember his voice on certain recordings that my mom and sister still have, and all I could really remember him saying from his sermons was, "God is a good God," you know. And somehow I still grew up with a fear and thought that God was a punishing God, and we'll get to that in a little bit. Brooklyn, New York, was born there, moved out to South Bay, California, Gardena. Long Beach area, you know, Manhattan Beach, Venice Beach, all those lovely little places. Gardena wasn't as beautiful as Venice or anything like that, but nevertheless, it was a nice little corner of the world where I grew up. And, you know, that's where my mom and dad got a divorce. And, you know, my dad, from me looking back now, my dad probably is an alcoholic because I do remember alcohol. I do remember him coming several times visiting me in my teen years, and you know, he always pulled up saying, "Yeah, I got a 12-pack. I want to have a beer with my son." You know, those are the latest memories that I have of my father. He left when I was really young, however. My mom did the best she could with what she was left. I am a product of welfare, government cheese, government bread, all of that stuff, and it gave me the sustenance I needed. You know, I don't know if it was because of all that I, you know, am an alcoholic or anything like that, but nevertheless, I am an alcoholic, and I can always remember, and you hear everybody say it, you know, I always felt different. I always felt something was missing in my life, and I always thought it was just my dad, and, you know, or something was going on, and, you know, I could always remember how I felt like my mom was putting so much demands on me as a child and everything like that, and, you know, my mom was just doing the best she could with what she had, you know, and I think she still did a good job, even though, you know, I turned out to be an alcoholic bum. So speed it up a little bit. My first drink was roughly at the age of, I believe it was 13, and it was me and a couple of guys from the neighborhood in Gardena, and we walked into this liquor mart. It was called Stop and Go Liquor. And we bet each other that we couldn't go in and steal any alcohol. And at the time, in June, it was a hot day, and I was wearing a winter jacket, and I walked into the store, and I walked straight back to the wine back there, and I grabbed like three or four bottles of Night Train and a few bottles of Thunderbird. You know, the real good stuff. It had the metal cap, you know? So went in there, stuffed it down my pants, and took off running out of the liquor store. We went down to this one alley that everybody used to hang out, and I used to watch everybody smoke weed and drink. And, you know, I hadn't done anything at that point yet until that day. And within about, I don't know, about an hour or so, all those bottles were gone, and so was I. And the last memory I have of that was running up and down the alley saying I could fly as I'm pirouetting through the air. And I really don't have a memory after that. I woke up the next morning I believe it was the next morning. I woke up the next morning, I sat up out of bed, and the pillow came up with me. And I was like, what the hell is going on? So I peeled the pillow off my face, and it was saturated in blood, and I started coming to a little bit more, and I was looking around the room, and there was handprints of blood, handprints on the door and everything, and I was like, what the hell happened? So I walked into the bathroom, mind you, my first drink, this is my first experience with alcohol, with anything, and it was a blackout drunk. I walked in the bathroom, looked in the mirror, and the whole side of my face was just one big slice of pizza. And I was like, what the hell happened? And immediately, all I felt, I felt fear, and then I felt the after effects of the alcohol. I was still drunk. I was hungover. I felt the alcohol and that warm, fuzzy feeling in my stomach, and I was thinking to myself, what can I do to keep this going? That was my first thought, was what can I do to keep this going? And I didn't think I had a problem. I just figured, you know, hey, you know, it just is what it is. This is the way everybody, this has got to be the way my friends drink. This is the way they got to feel. I got to keep this feeling because it felt good. Even though I was nauseous and I was puking and I couldn't see straight still, I still wanted that feeling. I wanted to keep that. It wasn't the effects. It was the effects. It wasn't what I was seeing. It was just that feeling down in my core, and I wanted to keep that going. Later on, I found out that I drunk off my ass. I ended up going home, and I got on my BMX bike, and I was riding my bike, and I was hogging the front end so much I kept flipping over the handlebars and landing on my face. Kept flipping over the handlebars and landing on my face. My friend said that's all I did. I did that like 8 times. They finally took my bike away from me and took me home and threw me in my bed. And apparently my first drink lasted maybe 3 or 4 hours because that's what I did. I just went home, and they said I was out after that. So that was my experience with alcohol. We're going to speed it up a little bit more, get through this so we can get to the solution, or at least get to what happened. Shortly after that, I started smoking weed. My friends, everybody was smoking weed. I was like, okay, you know, the wine was good. You know, I love beer, by the way. I absolutely love beer. I never was a hard I only liked hard alcohol for the effects. I just didn't like the way it tasted. I didn't like that burning, like, isopropyl alcohol feeling down my... I just didn't like that. I know there's a lot of people in here who probably absolutely love that feeling. I didn't. But I did love the effects of it. I did love the effects of what happened once it hit my stomach and it warmed me up on the inside out and I started feeling the effects of alcohol. I just didn't like that taste. But beer, I loved the taste of beer. Malt liquor was my shit. Malt liquor was my shit. And my favorite beer is 211 Steel Reserve. And you throw that in the freezer for 45 minutes with a mug. You pull them both out and you crack it and you pour it. And to me, it was the best thing since sliced bread. It really was. Anyway, marijuana got thrown into the mix, and I found very quickly that mixing alcohol with marijuana just wasn't my thing because it put me directly into the spins and directly into puking. So at a very young age, I started playing with the fact of learning how to balance. You know, how many beers can I drink and wait before I can actually smoke weed, or how much weed can I smoke and wait before I can actually have a beer? Because when you start drinking beer, you start thinking you can take on the world, so you want everybody to think you're a badass, so you're going to go ahead and smoke the weed, and knowing what's going to happen, so you learn how to time that out. Or when you smoke weed first, you get cottonmouth, and then you need the beer, and, you know, it's a whirlwind, you know, so you just get all screwed up. And I was doing a lot of puking, a lot of spinning, you know, I really was. Roughly around the age of, mind you, you know, through elementary, through the elementary sixth grade, 13 years old, through junior high, elementary through junior high, I was going to school. I wasn't doing very well. I managed to get some grades, and I managed to make it into high school. By the time I hit 10th grade, I wasn't going to school at all. By the time I hit 10th grade, I was introduced to a gentleman around the corner from where I was living, and he was a plumber, and I got it stuck in my head. I needed to work. I needed to work to support my mom, to help my mom, you know, and that's where I was introduced to crystal meth. A little bit of a disclaimer here. I did a lot of drugs. If that, it's part of my story. I know this is an AA meeting, but this is a huge part of my story with the alcohol. I had a devil's triangle in my life that I just could not escape, and that was weed, alcohol, well, actually weed, malt liquor, and crystal meth. So I was introduced to crystal meth at roughly about 16 years of age, somewhere around there, and through this one biker guy, and he was a plumber, and he offered me a job, and he paid me in meth, you know, and it was a great, great relationship for many years to come. It really was, because he ended up firing me after a couple years, but he introduced me to one of his customers who was a carpet layer, so I immediately changed positions as far as jobs from being a plumber's apprentice to a carpet installer, and he paid me in meth as well. And it was a great relationship with him. I was with Mark for many years. I did a lot of things with Mark. He introduced me to a lot of different things, and even when I was off on my own, I did what we do. We go out and we experiment. You know, I experimented with just about everything. The only thing I always promised myself I wouldn't do was, and that was to shoot up, and I did that once, and I never did it again because I loved it way too much. You know, I never touched heroin, but I did shoot up meth, and I would never do that again. It was way too good. I instantly saw myself dead, and I just couldn't do that again. What eventually ended up happening was roughly around the age of 18 or 19, my mom thought it would be a good idea to move us out of South Bay and move us to the San Fernando Valley. And, I still had a grip on things. I still had friends. I still looked okay. You know, I wasn't too beat up or anything like that. But, you know, I know I was in some kind of spiral because I started noticing things weren't quite normal. You know, I noticed that the people that didn't drink and use, or at least the people that I thought maybe possibly didn't drink or use, or they hid it really well, were doing much better than me. And I never understood why I couldn't concentrate at school, why I couldn't just go to school, because something inside of me just told me I need to be there, but I just never went. My ideas were way better than anybody else's. You know, and so I just kept doing what I thought what I wanted to do, you know, just like every other good self-centered alcoholic would do. And so I continued doing that, and we moved to the San Fernando Valley, and we ended up, my aunt, my mom's sister, was running an apartment complex in the San Fernando Valley under Section 8. My mom was still on welfare and everything, and so we ended up moving into a Section 8 place. And it didn't take long at all, maybe, I don't know, 3 weeks before I was able to find exactly what I was looking for. You know, I was able to find the right person to buy me my malt liquor. I was able to find the weed dealer. And it didn't take long for me to hang out in the apartment building to find out where to get meth. Although I had to go through a lot of crack dealers to get to that, but that was okay, you know. I didn't have a problem with that whatsoever. Smoked crack for a couple of times, and each stint was, you know, several years. I had a pretty bad crack problem, too. But good old meth got me off of that. Started getting in trouble with the law a couple of times. I ended up getting a couple DUIs, you know, messing around in Palmdale, messing around in Bakersfield, stuff like that. And I ended up with a couple DUIs. Nothing serious. My first one was about a year before the laws got real strict. You know, it turned out to be a wet reckless and $500 fine and slap on the wrist, and that was done. A year later, my second DUI, or my actual real first one, or whatever you want to call it, that's when things were pretty bad. Or good, or however you want to look at it. I ended up with a DUI on my record. I ended up having to go to an alcohol school for 18 months, and I can't even remember what the fine was. I worked that off in community service for, God, it must have taken me 3 years to work that off. But even that still didn't work, you know. I was going to the alcohol school, pulling up in my Nissan Sentra with an ice chest of 22-ounce cans of Bud Ice and one in my lap. and I was going into my class, and I had to make sure those were on ice, so when I came out, there was a couple cold ones for me waiting for after I was done with my alcohol class. And that's just the way I did things, you know. As far as work and stuff like that, you know, I was able to maintain my life somewhat. You know, I'd have nowhere in jobs, warehouse jobs, you know, stuff like that. Just anything that would pay me enough just to be able to support my habit while I was still living at home with mommy, you know. And I still thought that I got this. It's okay. Once this alcohol class is over, I'm going to get a hold of my life and I'm going to be somebody. I'm going to do something. And that's the lie that I kept telling myself. You know, I kept on and kept on doing these things. What happened? There was a lot of hers. There was a lot of moments. There was a lot of times, a lot of different drugs, a lot of different things. But what absolutely brought me to my knees was, hell, even towards the end, I wasn't even drinking as much. You know, what brought me to my knees was meth. I consider myself an alcoholic because that's where it started. And that's where it'll all start again if I go out. Because I know the way I think. I'll lie to myself. I'll just have a beer. You know, it's okay. I'll just have a beer. And I know what happens with me. I drink a beer. I start getting buzzed. And it's like, okay, now it's time to call the dope man. That's what I do. That's exactly what I do. I think I can control the alcohol and then I move into something else. What happened was I was at her house. And I was in the bathroom and I kind of caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror. And this was... Oh, before that, hold on. Let's backtrack about 5 years. I apologize. I thought it'd be a good idea to start selling drugs and weed out of my mom's house in Pacoima. What ended up happening was I got some people pissed off at me, and they came over and started calling me a drug dealer and shit like that, and the manager happened to hear that and ended up kicking my mom out. We ended up moving a few blocks away. My mom allowed me to stay with her. We ended up moving a few blocks away, and the same thing happened. We ended up moving a couple miles away, and my mom just let me come, and that ended up happening. That went on for like 5 years. I got my mom kicked out of a place for a year, for 5 years. And then finally, at the last place, the same thing almost happened. Before it could happen, though, my mom saw that I was doing a lot of drugs, even though I was coming home and having a beer with her and everything. She was just drinking with me to appease herself, to tolerate my behavior and everything. And what ended up happening is I woke up the next morning on one of these lovely days at this apartment. I ended up going to my big job, unloading boxes out of a truck. And that day I just happened to work some overtime because I wanted to make sure I had some extra beer money. And I came home that day, and all of her friends must have had a lot of friends that I didn't know about, because I walked in the house, and the house was empty, except for a pile of my stuff in the middle of the living room floor. And there was a note on it, and I'm going to paraphrase. Basically what the note said was, I can't watch you die anymore. The rent is paid till the end of the month. God bless and good luck. Poof, my mom was out of my life. My mom put up with me for many years, up until the age of roughly 26, 27, 28 years old, and I was still living off with mommy. Shortly thereafter, I was living with her, and I was in her bathroom, and I walked into the bathroom, or I was standing in the bathroom, and I was doing what we do in bathrooms, and I kind of caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror, and I did not recognize that man. I did not recognize who that was. It kind of startled me. I was like, oh, what the hell? And I didn't know who it was, and it hit me. I was like, wow, that's me. You know, and all I really saw, I mean, from what I remember seeing was someone dying, a skeleton, a gray-skinned skeleton. And that kind of scared me a little bit. And I thought to myself, I didn't want to die, you know. And it still took me, let's see, I was 28 at the time. It still took me another 8 years before I finally did something about that. But at that point, things started really unfolding for me. I ended up going to the Salvation Army because she wouldn't let me back in the house, and I had nowhere else to go. So I ended up going back to the Salvation Army. 2 weeks before graduation, I ended up leaving because she decided to have a PCP psychosis episode, and I needed to be there to take care of her. And it took about 3 months of that before I relapsed, and I don't even consider it a relapse because I never unlapsed to begin with. I didn't go there for myself. I was going there. I didn't go there for me. I went there for her. I went there for security. I went there to secure something, manipulating the situation. There was a lot of manipulation way before that. Everybody knows that. It's what we do, right? It's what we do when we're in our disease. So shortly after that, she got better, and believe it or not, after about 2 weeks of her being in this PCP psychosis or whatever, all it took was a couple lines of meth, and she was snapped out of it, and she was back to her normal self. Who'd have known? I would have given her that the second I walked in the door if I would have known. Yeah, pretty shitty, I know. It didn't take long after that to where we started fighting a lot, we started arguing a lot, standing in the bedroom, and she was standing at the bedroom door. She had a razor knife in her hand, and she says, "I can't take this anymore. You need to leave now." And I thought to myself, I could take the knife from her and beat her ass and get going, but at that point, I had never laid a hand on a woman, and I still haven't. Or I could run, so I decided to run. And I don't know what the hell happened that day, God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, but as I was running across that courtyard, there was my sister. She just happened to be in front of the apartment, and I just happened to just run across, and I saw her. She flung open the door, because she saw her behind me with the razor knife, and I supermanned into the car, and we closed the door, and she's pounding on the window, and we're taking off. And she took me directly to the Salvation Army. And that's where everything changed for me. This time I knew that if I didn't do something, I was going to die. Drinking wasn't working. Doing drugs wasn't working. Weed wasn't doing anything. Nothing was working for me anymore. All of my ideas were exhausted. Everything I did was exhausted. So she dropped me off the Salvation Army. And that's where things started changing for me. The first night there was very odd, very difficult, but for some reason I felt a sense of security. I felt safe. I knew that something was going to be different for me. I woke up that morning. The alarms go off at 5 a.m. over there. It's a work rehabilitation program, and the alarms go off at 5, and you're to be up, dressed, and out at breakfast by 6, and at the warehouse by 7. And that's what I did. I was half asleep for the whole first day, and I thought to myself, this is awesome. I'm going to sleep great tonight. The second night, I'm in my dorm room, and I just can't sleep. I'm tossing and turning. All I'm thinking about is out there. I need a fix. I need a drink. I need something. I need anything but what I'm in right now. And I don't know what it was. I got out of bed, and I hit my knees, and I did that alcoholic prayer that you hear everybody talking about. Maybe not everybody, but mine went like this. Please help. I don't know what to do. And I crawled back in bed, and I slept. And when I woke up, when the alarm went off in the morning, I got up out of bed, and something was different. It was literally like a little switch inside of me was flipped, and everything was just slightly cocked to the right, just a little bit, ever so slightly, and things were just different. It was at that moment, or actually I didn't realize what happened until about 2 weeks later, but my obsession was lifted, was absolutely lifted. Now, that's not to say that I haven't had fleeting thoughts, that I haven't had thoughts of, or anything like that, but that deep down inside feeling that causes you to just fuck it and run and go get what we need was gone, absolutely gone, and it still hasn't returned. And I thank God for that every single day. So what ended up happening inside the Salvation Army after that was that I was introduced to, it's a Christian-based program. I thought I had the Christian thing down. I thought I had the God thing down, but I was still afraid of my higher power. So, you know, I didn't immediately take off on the steps. After about 30 days of being in there, they allowed us to go out to go to meetings and stuff like that. And roughly about 35 days of sobriety, I ended up going to this one meeting. There was a guy at the Salvation Army who I got to know a little bit. His name was Randy, and God bless him. He found it necessary to go back out there and test the waters, and he's no longer with us now. I knew him for almost 10 years, and he ended up going back out there, and he turned out to be one of my best friends, and unfortunately, he's not with us anymore. Anyway, I ended up going out to this meeting to watch Randy take his one-year cake. He was one of those guys who went through the entire program, made a mistake just before graduation, and they restarted his program, so he was there for a whole year. And I ended up going to go give him support at this one meeting to take his cake, which that meeting turned out to be my home group for many years to come. And there that night, I met this one gentleman who shared, when he shared, he always walked that gray line of being completely offensive, but yet getting that point across. And I thought to myself, that's the kind of guy that I need to talk to. That's the guy that I want to be my sponsor. And it was on a Saturday. And I never got the balls up enough to ask him to be my sponsor, at least talk to me. And the next morning, I woke up after chapel, I went to the front desk, and I was telling this to one of the guys, and John, and John was like, oh, you're talking about Josh? Yeah, he's about to be here in about 20 minutes. He's going to be picking me up for a meeting. Talk to him then. So he comes walking in, and I ask him, look, you know, I heard you share last night, and, you know, I'm not looking for any big flashy sponsor like the rest of these guys in this house here, but I need someone who's going to help me. Would you consider sponsoring me? We sat inside the chapel for 45 minutes, and we immediately went through steps 1, 2, and 3. Changed my life immediately. Immediately I started on my fourth step, and that process took about 3 months, living at the Salvation Army and doing their work program, meeting their criteria, and doing everything that they required of us, and doing a fourth step, and still trying to get some sleep. I needed to break that up for a while. And step one was easy for me because I was in a place like the Salvation Army, and I was completely powerless over everything that I ever thought of, anything that was in front of me. That was easy for me. I was in complete, utter despair. Step one was pretty easy for me. I was willing to do anything else but what I was thinking. Step two came pretty simple for me at the time because I did believe in a God, and I did believe that he could restore me back to sanity, but I also believed at that time that if I didn't stick to that fine line that he'd come down and just zap me and everything would be all over. Somewhere down the road I learned something different, that is not necessarily true, because my God is a forgiving God. He will guide me. Even though I may not like his answers most of the time, he will still keep me out of trouble, and he will still keep me alive today. And that's important. Step three, making a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God as we understand him. Back then, absolutely. That was an easy thing for me to do. It really was, because my will was shit. My will was nothing. Everything that I wanted to do was not working. Nothing worked anymore. Why not let him take over? Why not let him do something with me? Because I was doing everything wrong. The fourth step, like I said, took a few months. Once I got through that, we sat in my sponsor's backyard for about 2.5 hours, and we went through that, completed step five. That went really well, and he had me go home for an hour that night and do what's suggested in the book. We take an hour to ourselves, we reflect upon what has just happened, and we make sure that we didn't skimp on any sand or any of the mortar while we're building our foundation. And that's what I did. And that night when I went to sleep, I had this very vivid dream, which I shared not too long ago, about going through the wilderness and all these little creatures popping up behind rocks and brush and bushes and bushes and shrubs and everything like that. And I had these powers, and I was zapping these little things and everything like that and just destroying them. And somehow, some way, I started burrowing through the ground, and I launched out. And as I launched out, there was this giant monster coming after me, and I turned around, I was shooting these lasers out of my hands and everything, and I destroyed it. And to me, I interpreted that as step seven, humbly asked him to remove my shortcomings, all those little demons and little characters that were jumping out everywhere were my character defects. It wasn't that all of that stuff was removed from my life, but I became very well aware of my behavior. And it manifested itself in a dream to me, and I honestly believe that's what happened. 8 and 9, still working on that. Believe it or not, it's a lifelong process for me. There's people that I'm probably never going to see, and I'm never going to know where they live today in order for me to make a direct amends. But I have prayed on it. 10, 11, and 12, I try and continue to do on a daily basis. As of late, for the past year, I have not been doing a very good job of that. The first 10 years of my sobriety has been the best 10 years of my life. The last 2 years of my sobriety have been very difficult, more so this last year than anything, more so these past, I guess, 9 months. I started slacking off to meeting. I started slacking off of meetings when I was still in the San Fernando Valley. What I got till another 7 minutes or something like that? So, oh, all the way to 6:30? Oh, I can take it all the way to the pin. Awesome. Golfers know what that means, right? The pin. Anyway. The first 10 years of my sobriety, I developed a lot of good relationships. I developed a very strong foundation. I developed a fellowship of men. I developed a fellowship of groups where no matter what I was doing, no matter what was going on, there was always some kind of event or someone's house I can go to, and I was always surrounded in recovery, and which was very healthy for me. My 11th year of sobriety, I started slacking off a little bit on meetings. I still went to the basic ones. I still went to my book study, my two men stags, and my Saturday night home group, which that was starting to slide away. I guess ego was starting to settle back in. You know, I stopped working with other alcoholics. I stopped working with my sponsees and stuff like that. I guess, and I use it as an excuse, they don't call me anymore, so whatever. You know, every time I didn't call my sponsor after about 2 or 3 days, he would always call me, and I never practiced that. I didn't practice that towards that 11th year or inside that 11th year. If I had to pinpoint exactly where things started sliding away and my old behavior started coming back in, I'm going to have to say it was in my, it was towards the end of my 10th year and in my 11th year. And things started getting a little difficult. I noticed, I can look back at it today and tell you that I've been struggling for a couple of years now. I've been struggling pretty hard. You know, I've been fighting things. I've been fighting, I've been resisting life on life's terms. You know, and I had been doing so well, accepting life for exactly the way it is and just walking through everything that I had to walk through. And that's what these steps taught me how to do. I don't know what happened. I don't know what I did wrong. I don't know what was going on, or even if I did anything wrong. But something started happening to me, you know, and I can see that today. I'm not going to sit here and try and analyze it. All I'm able to do right now is understand it and realize that something happened. Don't sit there and try and find out the exact moment, because I never will. Don't sit there and find out that exact moment, because I never will. Something happened inside of me. Self-will, selfishness started taking a hold of me. And I put my wife through a lot of stuff. I met my wife, I believe it was in 2010, 2009. We met at an AA convention. I'm not going to share that part in a general way, right? some things happened and everything like that. And one day about a year and a half later, she ended up calling me and we ended up going out. And that night it just so happens that I was speaking at the Radford Hall, and she met me there, and that's where we had our first kiss, and we ended up, our lives were good but confusing, and we were on again, off again, and it was all because of me, because I wasn't sure, or I didn't know, or I was afraid to commit, or just all that bullshit, you know. Bottom line is, my wife was the best thing that's ever happened to me in my entire life. She's a strong woman, she's a good woman, she's in this room tonight. And we moved out here to start a business, which is a successful business. Some of you people know what business it is. And we've been doing really good, and she's been taking really good care of me. And I cheated on her. I don't know why. I don't know if I was just tired of me or what was going on in my life. And a result of that, of me pushing her away, she's doing other things. I started working on, I thought I was working on working things out with her and everything like that, and while I was doing that, I was telling her one thing while I was still seeing the other girl. And I did it again. I have absolutely destroyed my marriage beyond any kind of repair. Any kind of repair. That's why I start off my pitch, because I'm a liar, I'm a manipulator, and I'm a cheat. I don't know what I'm going to do. One thing I know I'm going to do is I'm going to dive into these 12 steps. I'm going to do the best I can to accept life on life's terms for everything exactly the way it is, and pray for the strength to walk through it on a daily basis. It's been very difficult lately. How I haven't taken a drink lately is beyond me. Maybe it's because when the pain is great, we do the work. I don't know. At least that's my story. When the pain is great enough is when I decide to get off my ass and start doing the work. I have been calling my sponsor a little bit more than I used to. Today I spoke with him several times. And every time I talk to him, he reminds me of what this program is all about. You know, it's it truly is just trying to live in God's will. And that's all I'm trying to do as of an hour ago. I need to be reminded sometimes every 5 minutes, because I'm stuck in this mental vortex of just bullshit, and I keep bullshitting myself. I've literally developed a situation in my own head where I start believing the stuff that I'm thinking. I don't know if I'm mentally ill. I really don't know. I really don't know if I'm mentally ill or if this is just the way things are or whatever. I don't know if I've got a serious chemical imbalance. And I shared that with my sponsor. He says, just breathe. Just breathe. You know? So I've been breathing for the past hour. I'm not proud of myself. As a matter of fact, I'm very embarrassed to share that portion of my story, but I got to get that out. You know, I've got to get that out. That's the only way I can start to heal, regardless of what's going to happen after the meeting or tomorrow morning or whatever. It doesn't make a difference. It's all done. There's nothing I can do but move forward from this point. And the only way for me to be forward, to move forward from this point, is to be as honest as I possibly can, to continue to do these steps, pray on a daily basis, hit my knees in the morning, hit my knees at night. I used to do that. I used to do that every single day. Every single day in the morning, I'd hit my knees. At night, I'd hit my knees. I don't do that anymore. I lay in bed and pray, or I stand up and pray. I need to hit my knees. I need to show the submission to my higher power that I mean business. Maybe that's the key. Maybe that's what happened. Maybe that's the key. The one thing that I took away from my program that has changed me is that I stopped hitting my knees. It could be something as simple as that. I don't know. We're going to find out tonight, though. Because I'm hitting my knees tonight. If I got to get on all fours, I'm getting on all fours. I need this feeling to stop. You know, I'm always looking for instant gratification. You know, and that's the one thing that that I was never promised. I was never promised this in the 12 steps. The things that I was promised, though, is that I'll be able to accept things on life's terms, that at some point in my life I will have serenity, and that things will be okay if I'm willing to put the work in. Wow, I didn't think I'd get to that part. I really didn't think. I thought I was going to stray somewhere, but I did it, and I said it, and I do feel a little better. But faith without works is dead. And I know that now. I have proved that to myself today. I thought I could walk the walk without actually doing this, but you can't. It's impossible. You end up in a pretty messed up situation like me. I don't think I'm going to take a drink tonight. I really don't think so. I'm really pushing to make it to midnight tonight, and if any of you are my Facebook friends, I will post 12 at midnight tonight. We'll see what happens, though. I have faith in my higher power, and that I'll make it to midnight tonight, alive and sober. My name is George. Thank you all for being here. I hope somebody received a little something out of that, because I know I did. And thank you, Bree, for opening it up tonight. Thank you very much. May God be with you. God bless. I'm an alcoholic.
All right, you guys, let's give George another round of applause.